From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Marty Johnson reporting. The battle of words between Russia and Turkey continues. Over the downing of a Russian warplane today, with Russian Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan warning Moscow not to play with fire. Speaking in the city of Beirut, Erdogan accused Russia of playing with fire by attacking groups opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad under the pretext of fighting ISIS and by irresponsibly targeting trucks operating within Syria looking for commercial activities or humanitarian aid. Turkey's state-run news agency and a Turkish relief group have reported that Russian aircraft attacked a Turkish aid convoy inside Syria near the Turkish border, killing 7 people and wounding 10 on Wednesday. Russia acting angrily after the Turkish fighter jets shot down its warplane on Tuesday. Meantime, the detention of 2 prominent journalists is provoking international and national criticism, with Dorian Jones reporting from Istanbul.
Condemnation is growing over the jailing of 2 leading Turkish journalists. Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, the leader of the main opposition, Republican People's Party, described the arrest as a black day for democracy and freedom of press. The US Embassy, in a tweet, expressed great concern about what it said appears to be another media outlet under pressure. The editor of Turkey's Cumhuriyet newspaper, Can Dündar, and his Ankara bureau chief, Erdem Gül, are facing more than 20 years in jail on spying charges.
This is VOA News. French President François Hollande, presiding over today's National Memorial Service for victims, promised to crush the army of fanatics who carried out this month's attacks, the deadly terror attacks in Paris. The commemoration held in Paris began with a somber reading of the names and ages of the 130 people who died in the attacks claimed by the Islamic State group.
Stéphane Alati, 39 ans.
Nick Alexander, 35 ans.
It's been 2 weeks since Islamic State militants swept through Paris, setting off their suicide vests and opening fire on innocent victims in several locations, including a crowded concert hall. They also set off a firestorm of reaction in the international arena as countries march up to help participate in putting down the ISIS group responsible. Authorities in Mali have arrested 2 people in connection with a terrorist attack that killed 22 people at an upscale hotel in Bamako. Catherine Hoxha has the latest for VOA from Bamako.
Speaking at the St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Parish in Nairobi's Kangemi slum, Pope Francis did not shy away from making his thoughts known on urban poverty.
Estoy aquí porque quiero que sepan que sus alegrías y esperanzas.
The Pope said he understands the difficulties the people face each day, as well as their hopes and sorrows. The crowd cheered as the Pope said that to deny a family water under any bureaucratic pretext whatsoever was a great injustice. He said lack of access to infrastructure and basic services is a serious problem. The pontiff chastised what he called minorities who cling to power and wealth and selfishly squander. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Obviously, that was a report on the Pope's visit to Kenya. Police in Colorado Springs, Colorado, say they have a gunman in custody after a 5-hour standoff at a Planned Parenthood office which injured 11 people, including 5 police officers. It's now known that 3, including 1 police officer, are dead. There was a lot of shouting, but no verbal communications until officers were finally able to contact the individual and get him to surrender. Police are still trying to ascertain whether anyone was left inside the Planned Parenthood offices. Colorado Springs Mayor John Souther said the police showed untold valor. Chicago police have made an arrest in the shooting death of a 9-year-old boy whose alleged gang-related death has sparked outrage in that city. In a press conference today, Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy announced the arrest of 27-year-old Corey Morgan, charged with first-degree murder in what he called the unfathomable targeted execution of Tyshawn Lee. Chicago police say the boy was lured into an alley and killed because of his family's gang involvement. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me today on the show are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor of National Journal, and Abderrahim Fukara, Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV, and here are the issues. French President Francois Hollande failed to recruit Russia into a grand coalition against Islamic State that would include the ouster of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Meanwhile, Russia slapped economic sanctions on Turkey over the Turkish shootdown of a Russian warplane, and the issue of Syrian refugees simmered as President Obama argued with Republicans over his plan to resettle 10,000 Syrians in the United States in 2016. And in Argentina, the Peronist regime that ruled the country for a dozen years was defeated by Mauricio Macri, the mayor of Buenos Aires, and a politician bent on freeing the Argentine economy from government controls. Well, Abdi, I'm going to start with you, and you're going to explain exactly what's going on in Syria at the moment. On the one hand, Russian President Putin said he really wanted to be a part of an alliance with the French president and others, but there's this impediment of Assad and whether he stays or goes.
Absolutely. I think that emotionally, Paris and Moscow are probably closer now than they have been ever for a long, long time, given what happened in Paris, given what happened to the Russian plane over the Sinai. We heard those words directly from the two leaders. But when it actually comes to doing what Hollande wanted to do, which is to enlist the Russians to fight ISIS in Syria and yet work out some sort of deal to phase out Bashar. Bashar obviously has proven yet again that he's way too important for the Russians for Putin to agree to that kind of grand bargain with the French.
Tom?
It's a little confusing, Fred. There are elements for optimism and there are elements for the usual negativism. I never thought I would hear President Putin say, as he did, "We are ready to cooperate with the coalition, which is led by the United States." That is an un-Putin-like statement, but taken at face value, that's a cause for encouragement. But as Abdi has said, the future of President Assad of Syria is a problem. President Hollande, meeting with President Putin, said, of course, Assad cannot play any role in the future of his country. Then at another point in their dialogue, Putin says Syria can only be settled through political conversation. So there's all sorts of contradictory and elements here, but I tend to agree that the Russians are reeling, first from the loss of the plane to an ISIS bomb in the Sinai Peninsula, and then the Turkish shootdown of a Russian airplane, the loss of life of the pilot and a Marine who was on a helicopter sent to try to find the two missing pilots. So it's
a mess.
if you read the words, they seem slightly more hopeful than less, but words don't often in this part of the world get translated into deeds, especially very easily.
I was interested in that, and Tom followed up on it too. What you said about the Russians and the French probably are actually emotionally closer than they've been in many, many years, maybe since, well, I don't need to date it, but it's true. You just wonder, isn't there some kind of a deal, and I'm purely speculating here, where they sort of agree, okay, Assad will stay for now, and the Russians say, well, don't worry, we'll give you a private promise that he'll be gone in 18 months or something.
You know, obviously the idea of Bashar staying on for a transitional period, that's something that, you know, the West and some of its regional allies, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, they've sort of floated over the last few weeks since the General Assembly at the United Nations in September. The Russians, obviously, when the chips are down, the Russians see it very differently, because they see Bashar, first of all, as someone giving them an opportunity to tell the world, to tell potential allies elsewhere in the world, look, we stick with our allies through thick and thin. That's number one. And number two, for them, they have the extremist threat, as they call it, is much closer to home than, you know, people are talking about. It's not just in Syria. There are people who have been fighting in Syria from the former Soviet republics, Muslim Soviet republics fighting in Syria, even from Russia, Muslims from Russia fighting in Syria. What happens when they go back? What happens if Bashar leaves power? What happens to, you know, if there's some sort of a agreement which cannot stop those people from going back to Russia? So obviously, Putin is in a dilemma. And by the way, the dilemma in which the French president is not much less, because what happened in Paris, as tragic as it is, it has given him an opportunity to basically finally show the French that, you know, his leadership medal. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he came to D.C. to get something. He didn't get it. He went to Russia to get something. He didn't get it. Where does he go from here? Unclear.
Yeah, certainly unclear to me, Tom. Abdi raises the question of leadership. And you mentioned that Putin had said that, well, he would accept American leadership, but there doesn't seem to be much American leadership.
Well, it's really interesting to me, Fred. One of our close mutual friends is a Republican who has no use for this administration, has for years referred to President Obama as President Obummer. Mm. But I'm only struck by that because in the Washington Post, there was an op-ed column in the last few days by Dana Milbank, one of their chief political correspondents, who referred to President Obama in the same way half a dozen times in a few paragraphs. Mm-hmm. This guy is maybe is far less partisan than our friend, but he, I was kind of amazed that that level of pejorative, mm-hmm, would be lodged against President Obama. But there is a sense, and anyone who watched his press conference with, mm-hmm, President Hollande would come away saying, wondering whether critics are right about this. Hollande came out and said, we're going to get these bad guys no matter how long it takes. We're going to be strong and resolute, and we will do what has to be done. And President Obama kept saying things like, make no mistake, this is a long, hard road ahead. But the whole body language was not forceful. And yeah, it's amazing that even many Democrats now are sounding like Republicans on that aspect, mm-hmm, the aspect being presidential leadership.
Yeah, just for the record, I guess I'm very old-fashioned, but I don't think columnists ought to write about the President of the United States using the phrase Obummer.
You know, I thought...
Maybe I'm just stuffy, but I would not do that.
I thought it was over the line as, mm-hmm, well, but what was striking to me was that this was from a ostensible Democrat,
yeah,
who has had much to criticize President Obama on over the years, but not in terms quite as stark,
yeah,
as that.
Okay, let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Abdi Fakhara and Tom DeFrank. Abdi, what about American leadership? At the moment, I say this more as being sort of surprised rather than critical, that the president seems more interested in the soon-to-begin climate change conference in Paris than he does, at least at the moment, in exerting strong leadership in the Middle East.
I mean, it seems to
is
me
that unfair?
Not entirely, but it, mm-hmm, seems to me that to the extent that everyone in this situation is standing in a bad light, it seems to me that the light he is standing in is a little bit better than the light of some of the other leaders. I mean, he obviously has been very forceful recently in saying we will go after ISIS, we will do whatever is needed to support the French, to help them go after ISIS with us. We will work with the Russians if the Russians are willing to only strike at ISIS. But he obviously feels that he has wiggle room not to go all the way where either let's say, Hollande wants him to go, or where Erdogan of Turkey wants him to go over the downing of the Russian aircraft. The voices coming out of Turkey is that Turkey is a NATO ally of the United States, and therefore President Obama should have been more forceful than he sounded. He obviously he didn't feel he had to sound as forceful at that. He said, let's calm down. But his interests are obviously elsewhere. I mean, the sense that you get from Obama is that he wants to manage the U.S. position in the Middle East until after the end of his term. His heart really lies elsewhere in the world, whether you're talking about climate change or interests with China in that part of the world.
Russia and Turkey, after this plane was shot down, Putin sounded as if he was personally hurt, and then went so far as to say that the U.S. knew the flight path of this Russian warplane that the Turks shot down, as if the U.S. contributed to that shootdown.
Well, Putin first, he began by saying this was a stab in the back,
yeah,
which I thought was a little melodramatic. But his whole dialogue seemed to suggest that the United States was an unindicted co-conspirator here. At the Pentagon, military officials were quite emphatic. The Pentagon said, we heard all 10 of the warnings that the Turkish F-16 crews gave to the Russian pilots, which were ignored. Now, some say maybe they were on different frequencies. I think the navigator of that plane has now been interviewed and says, not surprisingly, that we never heard any such warning. So everybody's maneuvering here, posturing, but I think the notion that the U.S. was complicit here is a little preposterous, even by Putin standards.
Well, what about it, Abdi? There have been these economic sanctions applied or about to be applied. Is this more a tempest in a teapot, or is this something that Putin and Russians really did feel was something like a stab in the back?
I think, you know, looked at from a certain perspective, this is very serious. I mean, given that Putin's main asset domestically over the last few years, especially since Ukraine, has been nationalistic fervor in Russia. Mm-hmm. That has been his main tool. And for something like this to have happened, it makes it very difficult for him, obviously, to do anything militarily. He cannot do it because Turkey is a NATO member after all. But he has to be seen as doing something. What? Economic sanctions? Yes. He's been making a lot of, he and Lavrov, his foreign minister, have been making a lot of noises about that. Ultimately, sanctions hurt both Turkey and Russia, mm-hmm. given the extent of the economic exchange between the two of them.
Why can't the Turks apologize? I mean, some sort of half apology or something.
Well, you know, that's how nations are sometimes destroyed, because if you believe that your sovereignty has been infringed and then you apologize to a foreign power domestically, that's not going to help you. And he went straight to it, Erdogan. He said, this has been an infringement of Turkish sovereignty. He also is just coming out of an election and riding high on nationalistic fervor
in
Turkey. It makes it very intractable.
So he certainly won that election. Well, let's turn to one other thing, and that's the question of Syrian refugees in the United States, where there seems to be a real impasse. There are, 31 governors, I think, of the 50 states. All but one are Republicans. And now the president, or at least the White House, has said, look, this is my authority. I can bring these refugees in who are from Syria, and I can send them to your state. You have no authority to block it. That seems as if they're both claiming sovereignty in that, too.
Right, exactly right. I think the president is probably right from a legalistic standpoint, from a political standpoint. Bringing refugees in right now is very unpopular, except we're talking about a year, 18 months, or 2 years, even under the best of circumstances because of the vetting. It does just seem small for critics to say, well, we can't tolerate 10,000 Syrian refugees when other countries, Britain and others, are going to take tens of thousands.
Yeah.
But I know the Democrats running for president don't want this to happen, because it's a good it's the sort of issue that turns voters out, and you know, angry voters or voters who vote, and so I think politically this is probably going to hurt Democrats running for president more than it hurts President Obama.
Abdi, what do you think? Can this be worked out? I suspect it can, but not at the moment.
Not at the moment, not in light of what happened in Paris and not in light of everything that's been said here in the United States about what happened in Paris. And I sometimes wonder whether this storm over accepting Syrian refugees in the United States would have been as big as it is had it come after an attack like the one that happened in Paris, but not during election season here in the United States. My hunch tells me that the storm would have been smaller. Mm-hmm. But we all know the United States of, you know, post 9/11 is not the United States of what it was before. Now, security issues are very, very, very important, obviously, to Americans. They're very closely scrutinized. Problem becomes, in addition to being a problem for Syrian refugees, it becomes a problem for the United States. It becomes a PR problem.
Yeah, I'll return to that after we have another break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Tom DeFrank and Abdi Fakara. I want to follow up on what you were saying, Abdi, and that is, what if there had not been the attacks in Paris and the president had made the same proposal, I want to bring in 10,000 Syrian refugees? I don't think there'd been much opposition at all.
I don't think there would have been as much opposition, but also I think that the Democrats would have been in better shape defending that, that decision. But the problem, as I was saying before the break, becomes a real problem for the United States in terms of PR, in terms of its international standing. You know, for the United States, its image abroad, it's not just a question of image. Mm-hmm. It has security implications because the U.S. is known throughout its history as a country that has welcomed refugees. Mm-hmm. It uses that image of hospitality to fight all sorts of, you know, negative attitudes outside, which are sometimes translated into security threats. Mm-hmm. But it is what it is. It's election season, and people are worried about their security.
And the poll numbers are on the Republican side on this, at least for now. In fact, I saw some that were taken, a poll that was taken earlier, maybe 5 or 6 days ago, and it was really pretty overwhelming.
It was almost 60% opposed to any Syrian refugees.
If asked this question, although I don't think this particular situation of most average voters would imagine it, but the idea that, well, why didn't we set up a no-fly zone or a safe haven or something in Syria? Wouldn't that be better? And of course, they're going to say, most voters are going to say, well, yes, that would be better. But I don't think that it occurred to too many people on their own without a little prodding by pollster. Well, let's turn to Argentina. I happen to be particularly interested in Argentina for no particular reason, except I've just followed the whole story of the battle between the former government and bondholders in the United States, and it gets into international finance in Argentina and so on. My question is this, and I'll start with you, Abdi. Maybe the election of a non-Peronist in Argentina is not as significant as people think, but it's been questioned, or this issue has been raised, and the issue is, does this begin a wave in Latin America against the so-called left-wing populace in Venezuela and Brazil and Bolivia and other countries, and we'll have a new Latin America that's more capitalist, more friendly to the United States? I think that is possible. That may be overinterpreting what's happened in Argentina.
You know, I'm only going to speak to the extent that I was able to speak to people in Latin America in recent trips to Brazil and Venezuela about this. Obviously, there are people in Latin America who truly believe that what is described as the Latin American left is real. But there are also a lot of them who think that there's nothing leftist about it, not in Brazil, not in Venezuela, not in Argentina. So while that debate continues in that part of the world, I think there are two things about the election in Argentina that I would like to say. One is, obviously, we still don't know how the new guy will tackle what he describes as Argentina's colossal economic problems. He hasn't laid out a clear vision of
it yet. But he has asked for patience.
But he has asked for patience. And the other thing is that we understand from everything he's said that he obviously wants better relations with the United States, whether Argentina is part of a real left or not. He obviously wants better relations, and he sees that as one engine stimulating economic growth in his country. But the noises that he also made about Venezuela are interesting. And it just tells you that, you know, if there was ever a notion of a united left in Latin America, that basically with President Obama having peeled off Cuba by normalizing relations with Cuba, that this notion of the Latin left is basically undergoing a serious revision, knowing that a lot of people in Latin America feel that ever since 2003, when Bush devoted so much attention and energy to Iraq, they've been sort of ignored. And, you know, this may be the beginning of starting a new chapter, although the current guy in the White House, his main interest is not Latin America. Yeah. His primary interest is China and elsewhere.
Well, that's certainly true, Tom. One of the problems that the, I would call left-wing regimes, they might not call themselves that, but in Brazil and Venezuela and in Argentina, was the economy was in bad, is in bad shape in all of them, probably the worst in Venezuela, but nonetheless, there were serious economic troubles.
Right, and I think the new president of Argentina understands it's going to take him a while to address that, but the symbolism is important, and again, so we'll have to see how the words are backed up by actions, but the new president said that we will continue to have strong differences with the United States, but in my government, the American embassy is not going to be the embassy of an enemy. So words sometimes count, and I think the body language, at least, is more optimistic.
Mm-hmm. What about Venezuela? I didn't realize you'd been there, Abdi. You mentioned you have. I've seen, at least among Americans, as sort of the economic basket case of Latin America. Is that, are we seeing it accurately?
Well, Venezuela is obviously a very rich country, not just in terms of oil, being an oil exporter, but, you know, in terms of agriculture, in all sorts of ways. But it's hard to see where it's going, first because of the domestic divisions and the recriminations, quite honestly. We've seen in recent months, for example, we've seen huge lines of Venezuelans outside supermarkets to buy what? Some of the basic things like toilet paper. So, you know, it's facing serious domestic division and polarization. Internationally, now that Cuba has normalized relations with the United States, I'm sure the Venezuelans are also asking themselves some serious questions about where their relations with Cuba are going and where relations with the rest of Latin America, given what, you know, the new guy in Argentina has been saying about Venezuela, where they are going.
That's a good point. And, you know, it might be wiser if the Venezuelans thought about this, that if they're going to normalize relations with the United States, they could do it on more favorable terms with this administration than possibly a Republican administration that follows. Republicans, so many of them have been critical of the a change in relations with Cuba, which I think there's no turning back on that, but it might be wise for the Venezuelans to do what the Cubans did.
Venezuelans probably.
And now.
Probably should seize the moment because you're right. This president, who is more sympathetic to those sorts of realities, is president for 14 more months. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I don't think the next president, if he or she is a Democrat or a Republican, will be quite that amenable.
Is something like that possible with this regime? They seem to be in Venezuela, I'm talking about.
Well, it seems to me that one of the dilemmas of the Venezuelans is that they had what the right in Venezuela describes as an autocrat in the form of the late President Chavez. Chavez, he had a lot of charisma. Like him or dislike him, he was able to impose his will and to be seen as being very charismatic. Maduro, the current one, obviously lacks that charisma, and he doesn't have the sort of revolutionary background that Chavez had to be able to, if not unite all Venezuelans around a particular decision, at least impose his will. We're seeing that he's really struggling to take Venezuela in any particular direction at this particular point in time.
Well, That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at the National Journal, Abderrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. This program was produced by Anya Zaleski. Our engineers were Jackson Witt and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.